It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Lots of security news. We'll talk about an amazing Amazon review and a response from the company. Yet another IoT disaster and how not to issue automated security certificates. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 567, recorded Tuesday, July 5th, 2016. Hacking certificates. Security Now is brought to you by Adobe Marketing Cloud, introducing audio white papers for marketing. White papers read aloud to keep you up to date with the latest trends and technologies. Listen today by searching Audio White Papers for Marketing on iTunes or visit adobe.com for more information. And by Atlassian. Unleash your team's potential with collaborative software tools like HipChat and Jira that'll let you work and communicate better together. Visit Atlassian.com to learn more. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest security news with this man, the security in chief guy. What? I just blew your title. I used to call you the explainer in chief, but that doesn't really do it. What are we going to call you? The man in charge at Security Now, Steve Gibson, is here. Hi, Steve.
The man who named it.
The man who named it.
You said, how about we do a weekly security podcast? And I said, a what cast? and you said, you've never heard of podcasts? I said, no.
To be fair, this was in 2005 when no one had heard of podcasts. But
Now I've got awards on my shelf.
There you go.
Podcasts.
And did you come up with the name Security Now?
Yeah, I suggested Security Now.
I like it.
So we're at episode 567 as we close in on the end of year 11.
Wow.
Of this weekly podcast.
Wow.
With a bunch of interesting news. We've got an interesting update from Kaspersky. It might be a little skewed because they provide some software for protecting Android phones, but the statistics and their information about what's going on with ransomware on Android phones is interesting. And it turns out it's growing rapidly. We also have the news that was much tweeted this week of a security researcher successfully extracting the full disk encryption keys from his Android phone. Our friend Tavis Ormandy at Google's Project Zero, who really took Symantec/Norton down by taking a look inside of a core of pretty much all of their traffic inspection applications. They've got enterprise and consumer, all of this stuff that will protect you from stuff on the wire. Turns out, in fact, the mistakes are so bad in specifics that you can't really forgive them. Because, for example, in some cases, they used open source software that has 7-year-old vulnerabilities they didn't fix.
Oh my God.
So, how do you explain that away? Yeah. Brazil is at it again with WhatsApp. Boy, those Brazilians really have a thing for WhatsApp. Then we raise the question, what if you forget to re-register your router's setup domain name, as TP-Link did? We've got, of course, this week's IoT horror story. And I have to tell you about the one from 2 weeks ago that I shared with Padre when you were in Newport Beach, because we didn't talk about it last week.
We didn't,
Some errata, a miscellany. And then, unfortunately, the company Startcom that does the Start SSL certs decided that they liked what Let's Encrypt had done. They were going to do it too. Unfortunately, they unbelievably badly fumbled their execution. And when you think about it, automated certificate issuance is something you have to be really careful about, because certificates are powerful and you just don't want anybody to be able to get a certificate for pretty much any domain they want. But it turns out you could.
Oh,
so lots of fun stuff for the podcast this week.
Good. Not good at all. No. Well, if you don't mind, before we launch right into the thick of it, let's take a quick break for one of our sponsors, Adobe. I love it that Adobe is doing these. Marketing is nowadays, you know, this is not the loosey-goosey, seat-of-your-pants thing that I grew up with. Marketing has gotten very sophisticated. And, you know, thanks partly to the internet and to ways of quantifying what you're doing, it's gotten more and more challenging to keep up with the latest in marketing. If you're a marketing professional, even more important, if you're a business owner and you're doing your own marketing, you're going to love these. These are white papers from Adobe on marketing. They cover all sorts of stuff, like learning the difference between interaction metrics, engagement metrics, and value metrics, which I don't even know what that means, but it will really help you apparently figure out if your creative is doing its job, how to create personalized content that's relevant to customers using predictive analytics, creating a 360-degree view of each customer no matter where they're interacting with your brand, and a whole lot more. Now, these would be, of course, you could read them in print, but what's nice is they've got them recorded, and recorded by some of the best people ever. Well, I'll just play a little bit for you. This is podcast one, the new content frontier.
The new content frontier. This is your customers have grown accustomed to having massive amounts of content at their fingertips.
This is one of my favorite readers from Audible. He is so good. Your business has a new secret weapon. IT and marketing, from mobile analytics to mobile first, reinventing the customer experience, a new era of marketing magic. There's a ton of them.
Adobe presents the new era of marketing
magic. And you can listen to them for free. In fact, all you have to do is search for audio white papers for marketing on iTunes, and you'll gain great insight into the latest marketing trends. They're fun. They're fast. They range in length from 15 minutes to about half an hour. You can listen to them in the car on the way in, and by the time you get to work, you'll be an expert. Audio white papers for marketing from Adobe. Search for audio white papers for marketing and download them and listen to them. We thank Adobe for making these available and for helping support Security Now by buying an ad on the show to tell you about it. Adobe White Papers for Marketing. Thank you, Adobe Marketing Cloud, for your support.
Nice.
Okay, Steve.
So Kaspersky took a look at what they're seeing going on in the Android world. They have essentially instrumentation because they produce a mobile AV product that gives them some visibility into what's happening on the phones of their users. What they have seen, and we've never talked about this before. We've obviously talked about the Android problems with the media server module, and later we're going to come across. In fact, it's in the semantic story. One of the points that I made some months ago was how difficult it is for an interpreter to be careful about what it's interpreting. And then, for example, in the context of a JPEG, and of course, this is relevant to the media server module because it's trying to interpret MP4s and various forms of media. And the way this is done is that there's sort of a meta language that is the file itself, the JPEG file or the MP4. It's not just pure data. It's tags that represent pieces of things, and essentially an interpreter reads that block by block and does whatever it's being told to do. And so what we've seen, for example, over on the media server side on Android is this, no one can, it's like so riddled with bugs that we just keep getting more of them. So, but what's been interesting is that people are saying, yeah, okay, but Android phones don't seem to be infected. I mean, like no one's taking advantage of that. Of course, there was the concern when it when you could just receive an MMS message and get your phone taken over. That, you know, the potential for remote exploitation was so high there that we all, you know, jumped to fix that as quickly as possible. What Android or what Kaspersky is seeing is that mobile ransomware affected 136K of their of Android customers by April of 2016, so a few months ago, and that was nearly quadrupled from March of 2015. So it looks like, unfortunately, it's a growth segment. And as I said, they're, you know, they have a solution potentially for this. So there's a little bit of self-promotion probably going on here. But the statistics and details are interesting. They said one of the things that's interesting is that on that the strategy is different for mobile versus desktop. On a desktop, the ransomware favors file encryption because you typically have high-value, irreplaceable files sort of inherently in a desktop setting much more than a mobile setting. On a mobile device, you know, it's songs that you have somewhere else. Also, the vendors are actively backing phones up to the cloud so that you know, if your phone got encrypted, it's like, okay, fine, just do a hard reset and restore from the cloud, and you're back to the point where you had your last backup. So the point is that on mobile devices, rather than encrypting files, what they're seeing is blocking, what they call blocker-style ransomware. And when I saw the pictures in their blog posting about this, they sort of looked familiar. Like I've run across them just sort of in passing, but didn't really give them much thought. But you know, they come up and pretend to be, for example, the NSA or some government agency. Quoting from Kaspersky, they said blockers are the much more popular means to infect Android devices. On mobiles, they act simply by overlaying the user interface of every app with their own. So a victim can't use any application at all. PC owners can get rid of a blocker with relative ease. All they need to do is remove the hard drive, plug it into another computer. Not that that's easy for most people, but it is a workaround, and wipe out the blocker's files. Of course, that's sort of speaking from Kaspersky's standpoint. But they write, but you can't simply remove the main storage from your phone. It's soldered into the motherboard. That explains why blockers hold 99% of the mobile ransomware market, in quotes, such as it is. In 2014 through 2015, there were four main actors in this mobile ransomware space that dominated. There's something called SVPENG, PLETOR, Playtor, Small, and FUSOB. I wonder what that's an acronym for or an abbreviation
FUSOB,
for.
You know.
FUSOB, yeah. Right. At this time, Playtor, they said, has almost stopped its expansion. Hmm. Its creators have launched an infamous ace card Trojan and seem to be pouring their resources into developing and spreading that instead. Oh, so their attention kind of got diverted by a different Trojan they're working on. The developers of the SVPENG have also refocused mostly on the banking version of the Trojan.
Well, you got to go where the money is.
Yeah. So that leaves only two big mobile ransomware families, Small and FUSOB. As a result, in the 2015 to 2016 timeframe, these two Trojans represent more than 93% of the mobile ransomware space. And what's interesting is that they have a lot in common, but their territories deliberately don't overlap, which is sort of suspicious. Kaspersky says it's noteworthy that the FUSOB and Small Trojan families have a lot in common. Both display fake screens that pretend to be signed by authorities and accuse the victims of misdemeanor. Both say that a criminal case will be opened unless the user pays the fine, which, you know, a sophisticated, yeah, it does. A sophisticated user is
you
like,
know, if you just pay us $300, we won't have to send you to jail, you know.
Yeah, pay $300 to the NSA and we'll just give you a slap on the screen and let you go about your business and don't do that. Don't do that again. So they say both FUSOB and Small also offer rather strange ways to pay the ransom. This FUSOB suggests payment with iTunes gift cards, which apparently provides sufficient anonymization.
Yeah, but you can't turn those into cash. Maybe you can turn them into cash. That's really
weird. Or maybe the guys that did FUSOB just really like iTunes stuff and they want to buy some goodies. Yeah. Whereas Small offers victims the option of paying by the Kiwi payment system or the MoneyPack Express packet vouchers. And then they write, both were probably created by some Russian-speaking groups of cyber criminals, but with very different approaches.
Here's what it talks about. Because Kiwi and MoneyPack were not. You get a MoneyPack at 7-Eleven.
And then they talk about, and remember there was, in fact, it was Money Pack at 7-Eleven ran out because in the early day, in the early days of Crypto Locker, that was the way you paid for Crypto Locker before Bitcoin, and everyone was running to 7-Eleven to buy Money Packs, and the guy at 7-Eleven said, I don't know what's going on, but, you know, the J-hooks are all empty.
I got a real run on these things.
So this FUSOB detects the device's language, and if it's one of the post-Soviet Republic languages, FUSOB does nothing. Otherwise, it shows a screen that claims to come from the NSA and demands ransom from $100 to $200. The majority of FUSOB's victims, more than 41%, live in Germany. So that seems to be the main focus. Then second and third are the United Kingdom and the U.S. with 14.5% and 11.4% respectively.
If you live in Lithuania, they go, oh, never mind.
Well, that's so strange. That's where, although Small, and that's what's different. The Small family, almost 99% of Small's victims are located in the three countries that FUSOB avoids: Russia, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine. The Small ransomware shows a government-themed screen with payment instructions, threats, and a demand for, well, it's in rubles, from $700 to $3,500, which is roughly between $10 and $50 U.S., to unlock the infected device. And then there is an English locale version of Small also, but has a different block screen, of course, and mentions the FBI and demands a lot more money, $300, because, you know, we rich Americans, we're going to, with our expensive phones, we can afford more, apparently. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. They wrap up with a what to do, and they said, and of course, this is strongly good advice, install applications only from official shops such as Google Play, to be sure that no application makes its way onto your device from an untrusted source. Go to Android settings, choose security, and make sure that the unknown sources box is not checked. And of course, I'm sure it defaults to being having unknown sources.
That's right.
disabled.
Yeah.
And so the user would have to deliberately enable it if they wanted to get something. I actually did that for the Zio app when it was first made available because I just needed to get it from wherever it was. But then I turned it off afterwards because
Typically, what happens is when you sideload an app, it says, okay, we're going to enable this after lots of warnings, but only for this one download. And then it turns back on protection. So, yeah, I think they're very aware of the risks involved.
And then, of course, the standard advice from us and also from Kaspersky, regularly update your device's firmware and its installed apps. You can choose to update apps automatically, but you still need to have the system updated manually. And it's better to do that, they write, as soon as an over-the-air update arrives. And then, of course, Kaspersky says install a strong security solution. And, you know, we're sort of out of the mainstream.
And that's where it kind of bugs me because like, this is their company that makes the solution.
And yes, exactly. But, and Leah, wait till you hear what Symantec did. Oh, anyway. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's called you have to be very careful or you create a whole new attack surface. Because if something is sitting there inspecting what's coming in and it's got any problems.
Right. I don't think there's any evidence that you need antivirus on your on mobile platforms. Just, you know.
I think you're right. To me, that seems like a stretch too far.
Yeah.
Like, you know, most people, I'm running whatever that Microsoft thing is they keep changing the name of. Sometimes it's Windows Defender. Yeah. Sometimes it's the little greenhouse icon.
No, but it's different because on mobile, everything is kind of isolated. Certainly on the iPhone, there's no an antivirus can't do any of the things it would do on a desktop on an iPhone. All it could do, and in fact, as far as I know, it's the same thing on Android. All they do is scan downloads before you install it, and Google's already doing that on Android.
Right. Right.
So that's a little self-serving on their part, I think.
Yeah. So this got a lot of forwards to me. A guy who, took a good, hard, long look at Android's full disk encryption, so-called FDE, successfully extracted the keys from his device. And this was I don't remember now which version, but Qualcomm chipset. And Qualcomm goes to some lengths to protect this, as you would expect. But it turns out it's insufficient. So let's first recall how Apple's full disk encryption works. And that leads us to why it is so secure. In the factory, there is a 256-bit user ID, a unique ID, a UID, which is burned into the hardware. And it is, it's contained, it's write once, and that's read never. You cannot read that. Apple doesn't know what it is. There's literally, from any API, no way to get the key. Every device has one. Every device is unique. And there's no way to know what it is. The only thing you can do is give it work to do. Give this secure enclave a blob to encrypt or something to sign, and it'll do it. And it gives you the result. But it does that without ever exposing the key, and it cannot be removed. The user's password is, and here's this weird word they invented that everyone in the security industry puts in quotes because it's like, oh, come on, really? And that's, remember this, Leo? Tangled.
Tangled,
they tangle the user's password in some undocumented way as part of this so that the device by itself has no ability to do decryption. The user has to provide the password. It is then entangled. Sounds like some quantum, entanglement thing. It's then entangled with the secret that's in the chip, and that those two things, something that cannot be removed and cannot be exposed, but can only be used is required, and plus something that the user knows or provides is the other part of that. And short either of those two things, nothing's happening. So, and then on top of all that, there is a hardware enforced 80 millisecond overhead. And this is not short circuitable. It's that it takes the hardware 80 milliseconds to do whatever it's doing. So there's probably a deliberately complex password-based key derivation function, a PBKDF, which just takes 80 milliseconds. Can't make it any quicker because it's got a lot of work to do during that time. So it's not like a software delay that's been imposed. You can just, you know, code out that delay loop. It's actually doing work that it has to be done in order to derive the proper intermediate key given the unique ID and the user's password. So now Android. Starting with version 5, as we talked about back then, Android devices default to protecting all of the user's information by enabling full disk encryption. And remember that in the beginning, there was hardware acceleration for that, which paradoxically was not being used. And as a consequence, all of the encryption as it writes and decryption as it reads was being done in software. And unfortunately, that created enough overhead that people were turning it off because their phone was too slow with it turned on. But but ultimately, the hardware that was there from the beginning to accelerate this got engaged, got implemented, and then you know, background full disk encryption became the default. Now the good news is that Android's FDE, full disk encryption, is based upon a time-tested, well-known Linux kernel subsystem called DM-Crypt. So this is good news because it's not something that anyone, you know, some Qualcomm engineer or somebody else just sort of homebrewed. It's widely deployed and researched and pounded on and done right. However, as we know, an encryption system implementation may have no weaknesses, but the vulnerability can still be in its key management. That's the hard part. You know, getting the data encrypted securely, we pretty much know how to do that. But, you know, the algorithm's not secret. You know, it's a Linux kernel subsystem. There's open source. Everybody can go take a look at it. But as with any good crypto, the secret is not in the algorithm. It's in the key. And so what research has shown is that probably due to the comparatively clunky keyboard of mobile devices compared to a nice physical keyboard on a desktop, mobile users tend to choose easier to enter, lower entropy passwords. So, of course, that comes back a little bit later where if something makes this brute forceable, and that's essentially what happened, is Android implements, it's got this notion of a trust zone with a secure secondary processor. The problem is that there is an API that's documented, and trustlets, as they are called, you know, little trusted applets, trustlets, can be loaded into this processor's execution space. And the code in the trust zone can be extracted and reverse engineered, and has been. Consequently, several exploits have been found which breaks the trust zone's trust. Now, when this news came out, Google was quick to point out that this researcher had leveraged two known vulnerabilities, which the first of which was fixed in January of this year, and the second of which was fixed just over a month ago in May. So still pretty fresh, and an analysis. I don't remember now who did the analysis, but it turns out that an analysis of enterprise deployed Android devices showed that despite the fact that both patches existed, 37%, more than a third, of audited enterprise Android devices remain vulnerable, meaning that they can right now, using this system, which has been fully disclosed, the guy's got, he's got code on GitHub, a beautiful blog post. If anyone's interested in the, you know, in the intimate details of this, it's just a, it's a very nice expose of how he pulled this off, it allows any of these devices to have their full disk encryption keys extracted. So this researcher did pull the key and then wrote some software to do a simple brute force attack. Now, in his example, the attack was, the password was simple, so it found it like on the third guess. But the problem is we now know exactly what the algorithm is. In fact, right there, Leo, where you are, that's this week's picture of the week. That is the rather complex key flow for the Android full disk encryption with the trust zone and everything.
This is showing their entanglement here.
That's their version of tangling the password and the secrets. And essentially, the secrets are stored out in the non-secure processor in encrypted form, and then they are provided to the secure processor and decrypted when needed. So what's different is it is truly impossible to get the key off of an Apple device, an Apple mobile platform, onto a room full of GPU accelerated, you know, special purpose hardware to then brute force the key. That can be done on Android devices that have not had these two patches applied. And the problem is, it's never going to be as secure as an implementation where the hardware simply won't give it up. And in fact, in the comments at the end of that blog post, the author of Hashcat, who we've spoken of before, Jens Stub, has offered to accelerate the cracking. That is to implement that crazy algorithm or whatever you need in order to do brute forcing in his very fast and increasingly powerful Hashcat system. So
let me ask you, because I read this also, the implication is it's because Qualcomm is not doing its enclave properly, right?
Right.
If a phone didn't use Qualcomm, I mean, in other words, this isn't an Android issue; it's a Qualcomm issue.
Correct. Well, yes. So it's not if it didn't use Qualcomm. If it's okay. So the moral I was getting to is making things difficult is
difficult.
No longer good enough.
Yeah, right.
They need to be impossible.
Right.
And so, Qualcomm. You know, you look at that flow chart, and you know, your eyes cross. I mean, I spent some time with it. It's like, okay, yeah, it all makes sense, and I can see why they're doing what they're doing. But it's just they just didn't go far enough. The little bit of gray area got taken advantage of. It has to be impossible, and Apple understood that and invested in the hardware to do it. I mean, it's not like there's anything special or that's hard to do. Essentially, for example, that's what the Yubico goodies are. They've got the key inside, and they never give it up. It is a write once secret, and then it just uses that. So it's not hard to do. Qualcomm just didn't do it. I think they got overly complicated. You know, the idea of having trustlets. When I read that third parties can load trustlets into the secure processor, it's like, no. Take that bullet point off of the data sheet and, you know, lock this sucker down so that the nothing can get the key out of the hardware. So I think it's a problem that they're storing the key in encrypted form outside. You just don't want to do that. You want it to be absolutely inaccessible, period. And that isn't this architecture. So this is an architectural problem with this implementation. But I'm glad you clarified, Leo. You're right. It's nothing to do with Android per se. It's this particularly this particular implementation of the security architecture.
Now, almost all Android phones in the U.S., in fact, I would guess, almost all use Qualcomm chipsets for the radios. Some Samsung phones do not. They use Samsung's own Exynos chipsets. And I'm wondering, in that case, if there's a vulnerability.
Where the secret is.
Yeah. Well, the idea is it's a secure enclave a la Apple, right? Implemented by the chipset manufacturer. Is that
correct?
Right? Yeah.
Correct.
So it's just not well implemented by Qualcomm. It could be implemented better, yes?
Absolutely. Okay. Next version, it's like... Right. There's no reason that they wouldn't.
So it's not a flaw inherent in Android. It's a flaw in like the vast majority of Android hardware here in the U.S.
It's a flaw in the hardware.
Yeah.
Basically, they just didn't do the hardware right. They got a little too fancy, and for whatever reason, they made the key live out. I mean, they may have a reason. You know, they've had no opportunity to defend themselves. There may be like some, I don't know what it would be. Because I'd like to have an absolutely unextractable secret that binds this to the phone. That's the difference. If you can get that off the phone, then you can pour a room full of Hashcat driven GPUs on it, and then if you couple that with a weak password, because users tend not to do fancy passwords on their touchscreens. Then you got the double whammy.
You got to feel for Google a little bit. See, unlike Apple, which controls all this, Google's at the mercy of OEMs who are making Android hardware. And it may be one of the reasons, one of the rumors that's been strong this week is that Google is going to do their own phone. And it may be one of the, not a Nexus phone, which is manufactured by another company for Google at Google, kind of with Google's suggestions, but their own phone. And that... could be one of the reasons they want to do it. I wouldn't be surprised.
I think that would be good.
Yeah.
I mean, then if
they blow it, well, then we know we can blame Google.
Well, and I doubt they would. We know,
they know
Google
doing.
Understands security. Yeah. I would argue they're at the top of the pile. I mean, Apple and Google, they're very visible, but I have no argument with Google understanding security, which is a perfect segue. Into Tavis Ormandy's latest walk through somebody else's product. There was a lot of coverage of this. Oh, and I forgot to mention, I did not, just for everyone who's wondering if I'm going to talk about the Lenovo problem. There was a lot of activity just... Maybe I started seeing it yesterday, but a lot this morning about some sort of a bad problem with Lenovo. When I was going to cover it, but when I dug into it, it suddenly exploded because it's not just Lenovo. It's a whole bunch of other OEMs that made the mistake of using Intel's reference code for the system management, the SMM stuff. So I will explain it all next week. It got too big for me to get a grip on it today. This problem with Symantec and the both the Symantec label and the Norton label for consumers, Dan Gooden, writing for Ars Technica, said, I just love the beginning of this. He says, much of the product line from security firm Symantec contains a raft of vulnerabilities that expose millions of consumers, small businesses, and large organizations to self-replicating attacks that take complete control of their computers, a researcher warned Tuesday. Now, I would only dial that back on raft. That's really not a raft of vulnerabilities. It's a dinghy. It is an interpreter.
It's a small dinghy.
Yeah. It's an interpreter in the kernel, and you just don't want interpreters in the kernel if you can avoid it. That's what Windows did with GDI when they moved the graphics device interface into the kernel. And that's why a JPEG could take over your computer. Tavis is wonderful. He, of course, Google's Project Zero is a cross-vendor, we're just going to look at things and see if we can find problems. Tavis produced a detailed blog post, which begins, Symantec, as if we didn't know, is a popular vendor in the enterprise security market. Their flagship product is Symantec Endpoint Protection. They sell various products using the same, and here it is, the same core engine in several markets, including a consumer version under the Norton brand. Today, writes Tavis, we're publishing details of multiple critical vulnerabilities that we discovered, including many wormable remote code execution flaws. You know, I mean, you just don't want those words to be put together next to each other.
Wormable execution
flaws. Wormable remote code execution flaws. Ugh. Tavis writes, these vulnerabilities are as bad as it gets. They don't require any user interaction. They affect the default configuration. And the software runs at the highest privilege levels possible. In certain cases on Windows, vulnerable code is even loaded into the kernel, resulting in remote kernel memory corruption.
God.
As Symantec uses the same core engine across their entire product line, all Symantec and Norton branded antivirus products are affected by these vulnerabilities. And he enumerates just a few. He says, including Norton Security, Norton 360, and other legacy Norton products across all platforms, meaning Windows, Mac, Linux, Symantec Endpoint Protection, all versions, all platforms, Symantec Email Security, all platforms, Symantec Protection Engine, all platforms, Symantec Protection for SharePoint servers, and he says, and all the rest too. So it's like, oh my goodness. Some of these products cannot be automatically updated, he writes, and administrators must take immediate action to protect their networks. Symantec has published advisories for customers. In a coordinated disclosure shortly before Travis's post, Symantec issued its own advisory, which listed the 17 Symantec Enterprise products and 8 Norton consumer and small business products affected. And I have a link in the show notes for anyone who if you're using any Symantec AV, go update it like yesterday. Tavis wrote, because Symantec, and here it is, uses a filter driver to intercept all system I/O. I'll explain what that means in a second. Just emailing a file to a victim or sending them a link to a file which is an exploit is enough to trigger it. The victim does not need to open the file or interact with it in any way. Because no interaction is necessary to exploit it, this is a wormable vulnerability with potentially devastating consequences to Norton and Symantec customers. An attacker could easily compromise an entire enterprise fleet using a vulnerability like this. Network administrators should keep scenarios like this in mind When deciding to deploy antivirus, it's a significant trade-off in terms of increasing the attack surface. The flaws reside in the engine products used to reverse the compression which malware developers use to conceal their malicious payloads. The unpackers work by parsing code contained in files before they're allowed to be downloaded or executed. Because Symantec runs the unpackers directly in the operating system kernel, errors can allow attackers to gain complete control over the vulnerable machine. So, Travis wrote that one of the proof of concept exploits he devised works by exposing the unpacker to odd size records, which cause inputs to be incorrectly rounded up, resulting in a buffer overflow. A filter driver is officially sanctioned hooks in Windows, which allow a third party, Microsoft uses them too, allows a third party to essentially insert a shim. The idea was that dealing with the intricacies of the network interface adapter, the NIC, it's incredibly detailed. You have to really know your stuff. And it's in a whole different API down in the kernel than it is up in the application space. So there's interrupts flying around. You have to be very careful not to hog too much CPU. I mean, you know, this is in the kernel. This is the OS, and efficiency really matters. So what Microsoft did is they decided, okay, we cannot have people writing their own device drivers like redundantly, because that'll be a disaster. So we'll provide those, but then we'll allow people who have a need to layer their code between the device driver and the rest of the system, thus a shim. And that's what Symantec did. It's one piece of code, one filter driver, which installing a Symantec AV product installs into the kernel. And what this does is inspect all of the traffic, at least inbound. I'm not sure if it's outbound also, but it inspects it on the fly. And so one of the things that malware products do, one of the things that good products do, lots of products do it, is they compress their exes. All of my exes are compressed, not because they would be huge otherwise, but because the exe format, and I've grumbled about this in the past, the exe format is incredibly inefficient. Huge tracts of land. No, huge regions of null space. I mean, just huge. And it's like sitting there in the file. So the point is, anything that an exe compressor could examine this executable and say, what is this 12K of zeros? That's dumb. So we're going to instead put a tag and say, here lies in the original file 12K of zeros, and then not have any. So you just saved yourself 12K, and so on. It's like that. So, but the point is, that means that on the front of that executable needs to be a little interpreter, which itself runs when the OS loads the executable. The interpreter gets control and reads this compressed exe. And so, for example, it finds this little tag saying, here lies 12K of nulls, and it says, oh, and so it expands that on the fly in memory to back to the original 12K of empty space. So, but that means it's an interpreter. And this comes back to what we were talking about with the danger of running interpreters in the kernel. It's so easy to make a mistake. And Symantec did.
That's not a mistake. No, no. That's a good thing.
One that I forgot to mute.
Oh, don't worry. I like it.
I go around the house and turn off all my iOS devices.
Steve, if I were you, I'd turn it up because you never
except
know.
Except it's a little bit of a chorus, and it's sort of because they all receive
You have to do it once.
So. Yeah, exactly.
We should mention that sound occurs whenever somebody charges another copy of SpinRite to the old credit card.
And I always appreciate it. Yes. It keeps the lights on.
That's right.
Even though one of these lights is flickering on and off.
Keeps Fred employed as well.
So the 10,000-foot view is Microsoft has spent painful decades, and, you know, we've lived through them. Code Red, NIMDA, MS Blast. You know, how long, Leo, in the beginning of this podcast were we bemoaning the fact that email was running scripts? Remember those days?
Oh, yeah.
My Lord. It's like, turn that off. Yeah. And they finally did, as we talked about last week, but it took only 20 years. So Microsoft has spent painful decades carefully hardening the core Windows operating system. Then Symantec comes along and installs a bug-ridden traffic intercepting filter into the OS kernel, which completely compromises Microsoft's hard-won security. And so then again, this is a classic attack surface vulnerability that we've been talking about. This is a problem where with any add-on, we've seen them with other AVs and other sorts of, you know, other vendors' add-ons. Lenovo, of course, is constantly in trouble for this, where an otherwise relatively secure and hardened operating system, you know, Microsoft keeps talking about how, you know, Windows 10 is the most secure operating system ever. Except, yeah, then people load a bunch of this stuff on it. And it's cheese, Swiss cheese again. So, anyway, wow. And of course, you and Leo, you and I are careful and prefer to run ad blockers and we're careful about where we go and don't go on the internet and knock on wood. Is there any wood around here? Don't get ourselves infected. Okay, so.
Why don't we take a little break here?
Perfect. Good.
You take a sip.
Need to fill my coffee.
Yes, I thought so. You know, I sensed that. A little need for Java. Our show today brought to you by Atlassian. Developers agree if you're creating a large, complicated project with many moving parts and lots of people involved, you've got to have help. You've got to have tools that simplify the complexity, that help you get the job done. And nobody makes better tools than Atlassian. And I know that firsthand because we've been using Atlassian. Well, it started when we were doing our website. And we did it with the Agile methodology, which I'm now a big fan of. The idea Agile's kind of complicated, but the idea is that you break up a large project into smaller pieces, you assign the pieces, you keep track of who's doing what, and you get the job done, and you get it done better and faster. You use sprints and so forth. So Jira is designed to do all of that. I mean, it really is the tool for managing an Agile team. And if you've not tried Agile, highly recommend it. So we still use Jira. We used it for the development of our new apps, which are coming out soon. But we also use HipChat as a way to stay in touch. HipChat is like Instant Messenger on steroids. It's incredible. Not only is it a great way to communicate much better than email, it can be synchronous or asynchronous. You can do video chatting as well, but you can also use hundreds of integrations so that you can get all the tools, including Jira, in there that you use. which makes it so fun and so productive to use HipChat. We use it now for everything. I mean, we have a HipChat room for every show. We have a HipChat room for our new studio. We have a HipChat room for engineering. It's really the way to communicate. Confluence, another great product from Atlassian. Confluence is a way to document workflow and processes. We use it exactly. That's how we use it, document our equipment and our work processes. So all the work is there, and you can see what's going on. It's a really great tool. And if you're a programmer, and you probably use a versioning system. Everybody but Steve uses versioning. You might want to look at Bitbucket, which is the ultimate Git solution for professional teams. And these all come from Atlassian. And what's nice, you can try them all for free right now at Atlassian.com. Atlassian, A-T-L-A-S, like Atlas, S-I-A-N, two S's in there, .com. Try them out. I think you'll agree, Jira, Confluence, HipChat, and Bitbucket give your team everything they need to organize, discuss, and complete shared work. We love it. We use all the Atlassian programs all the time, and you will too. Atlassian.com, helping teams everywhere team up to create what's next. Steve, as a team of one, doesn't really probably need all of that.
Well, actually, I do have a little bit of errata, because my statement about not using versioning generated so much flack that I thought, okay. I need to
save that.
Correct the record. Well, we will get there.
Meanwhile, let's get our Brazilians here.
Yes. So we, these judges in Brazil just keep having a problem with the fact that WhatsApp is unable. I mean, actually, architecturally designed to be unable to decrypt the messages that apparently drug people are using it to communicate with. So, I don't know. once again,
this is going to be a big problem, and it's not just for Facebook.
You're right.
If countries insist, I mean, obviously what they want to do is put pressure on WhatsApp to have a back door.
Correct.
But there's no response that WhatsApp can give them. They just say,
we can't
give you. Take our money, but we can't. You can do anything you want. Throw us in jail.
As we know, WhatsApp is designed correctly so that it is impossible for them to decrypt the messages. So once and twice there have been WhatsApp outages caused by judges commanding that it be taken offline. But I'm sort of stepping on my story here. Last Thursday, a court in Brazil blocked a little over $6 million of Facebook's funds because, of course, Facebook owns WhatsApp. And apparently Facebook funds is what was available to be blocked. WhatsApp failed to turn over messages sought in a drug-related case. As I was writing this, I was thinking, this actually is kind of pure gold advertising that Facebook,
especially among the drug dealing public.
Yeah. It's worth way more than $6 million for Facebook, for WhatsApp to have this reputation of being such a problem, because we're sorry, we would love to help you, but we can't decrypt the traffic no matter what you do. So after repeated failure over 5 months to turn over this particular information for this particular drug-related case, Brazil's G1 News Service reported that a judge froze the funds, which are equal to WhatsApp's accumulated fines for non-compliance in the case. Because WhatsApp has no bank accounts in Brazil, the judge froze the funds owned by its parent, Facebook. The Brazilian court, however, did not, again, use provisions of Brazil's internet law that allows courts to shut down service in some cases of noncompliance with court orders. Of course, as we know, earlier this year, a judge ordered a 72-hour shutdown of WhatsApp, which angered so many of the service's 100 million Brazilian users that the shutdown was lifted after just a day, after about 24 hours, by another court who essentially overturned that judge's order. So Yeah, as I was thinking about this, it's like, wow, you know, I'm sure $6 million to Facebook. Okay, fine, take it. Great story. We're happy that people are. I mean, we're not happy that drug dealers are covering their tracks using our technology. But for people who want privacy, and have a legitimate use for it, WhatsApp does the job. So this was an interesting story. It sounds worse than it turns out to be. And that is that a very popular line of routers, you know, Soho, consumer routers, TP-Link, and they have some small enterprise equipment also. TP-Link, once upon a time, used the domain that was printed on the label on the underside of the router, tplinklogin.net. And also in the manual. And at some point, for whatever reason, they switched to tplinkwifi.net. And so their newer products use tplinkwifi.net as the configuration domain. The older ones use tplinklogin. So what happened in the news is that they weren't paying attention, and the tplinklogin.net, the original, technically retired, but still printed on the label and in the manuals of the older devices, expired. And somebody grabbed it and is interested in selling it for $2.5 million.
Oh, boy.
Okay, now, the good news is our friend Michael Horowitz, who writes the defensive computing column for InfoWorld, he pays a lot of attention to router issues, and I've got a couple links to share here in a minute. But so Michael researched it further, because, you know, that sounds like the end of the world, but it's not. Because what that label on the underside of the router does is it's regarded as easier to type that,
right,
than 192.168.
Yeah.
.0.1 or 254 or whatever.
Linksys does this. Netgear does it. Everybody does it.
Right.
Yeah.
So the router itself sees the browser making a request for tplink.wifi.net, has a little mini DNS server, and so returns the router's current gateway IP for that particular domain. All the ones it lets go through to real DNS servers, it just intercepts that one. And then that's an easy way, a shortcut of getting your browser to see the local router's configuration pages. So now, so what that means is anybody using it the way it was intended to be used inside the LAN, behind the router, to get to the router, tplinklogin.net, the technically the retired and no longer valid one, well, that router that has it printed on its label and in its manual, it's still going to take you to its own page. The only real danger is somebody outside of the LAN. I don't know why you would go to tplinklogin.net if you were not trying to get to your router from inside the LAN. But so it's a little sloppy that they let that go. If they, you know, a company as big as TP-Link, I think this was just inadvertent. And the problem is now maybe $2.5 million would be galling to pay some domain squatter for the right to get it back.
So this is interesting, because I always wondered how those redirects worked. It doesn't get to the public internet at all. It just goes, no. The router sees it and goes, oh, you mean me? Oh, yeah, I'm right here. So it doesn't matter. They don't even need the domain name.
No.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So anyway, Michael Horowitz got one, had one, verified even that when you change if you reconfigure the router so that it's got a different, like a weird gateway, like .9.9, it still redirects it to the current gateway IP, so it always works. It turns out that Michael operates a site, nice site, called routersecurity.org that we've never talked about before. And his coverage of this, which I thought was excellent, took me to routersecurity.org for the first time. And I noticed that he strongly recommends that savvy users simply avoid all of the consumer, and these are my words, blue box routers.
Yeah.
What he recommends is something called the Pepwave Surf Soho from Peplink. And
I've never heard of that.
I know. And it looks very nice, too. Take a look at it from the link in the show notes, Leo. Michael writes, I maintain a long write-up of its pros and cons at routersecurity.org. The Surf Soho, that's the name of the router, is a business class router. So it's not quite, it's a little more expensive than the cheesy blue boxes, but not enterprise grade. It's a business class router. He writes that is a big step up from consumer models, yet is reasonably priced and no harder to configure than the average consumer targeted router. He says, my only relationship with Peplink is that of a customer. But for example, I love it. When he's talking about this router, he says the router, for example, supports point-to-point VPN.
That's cool.
So you're able to use the router through the public internet to interconnect to remote networks. And he says, which is a feature I have sometimes used, he says, it does not support WPS, which is another reason to like it, because you don't want WPS in your router. So a lot of interesting features. For example, you could also, there's a WAN USB port on the back where you could plug one of the little cellular modems, and it will seamlessly, if your main connection to the internet goes down, it will seamlessly switch to using to backup using the cellular connection, and it supports all of the various carriers and other stuff. So anyway, I just wanted to point people at routersecurity.org. I know that it would be of interest to our listeners, and Michael, who listens to the podcast, thanks for the great coverage of this weird TP-Link story, and for making it clear that it's like not more of a tempest in a teapot. It's probably not going to affect people with older routers when they go back to try to navigate to their router's config page. Okay, now finally, this week's Internet of Things horror story. Okay, Leo, first I have to say, 2 weeks ago, we covered one that was just really like another one of these. Some guy bought a multi-camera internet surveillance system. I can't remember the brand, but we talked about it 2 weeks ago. I just wanted to sort of fill you in.
He set it up. Right? Foscam?
Huh?
It was Foscam, wasn't it? Oh, well, anyway, sorry? Go ahead. Foscam? Foscam.
I don't remember. Anyway, right. So he sets it up, decides it's not what he wants, and returns it. Then a couple of months later, he gets an email from the service that he registered it with saying that one of the cameras had sensed motion. And he goes, what? And clicks the link, and now he's looking at somebody else's home. So the short version of this is that it turns out that somebody repurchased the returned multi-camera surveillance system, set it up, created an account, and it turns out that you can, with the way the system is now, or it was, you could have multiple accounts all referring to the same camera system. So... And when the camera system sensed motion, it sent messages to everyone who had an account for that camera system. So anyway, just another example of, oh my goodness, this was not done right. And it was even worse too, because then it turns out when you look at it, the camera that you're viewing in real time, the the MAC address was in, I don't remember the details now, but something was like in the URL. So you could just increment them and cruise around through all of this company's customers' homes that were under surveillance by themselves and now by everybody else. So anyway, that we talked about 2 weeks ago. This week, we have a Wi-Fi AC plug, which has been withdrawn from Amazon. A security researcher, Matthew Garrett, created a one-star Amazon review. The plug was called the AUYOT, I think it was. I went looking for it this morning, and then I subsequently saw a note from The Verge saying that it had been pulled because I couldn't find it, and so that verified that it was gone. So anyway, Matthew's title is "Nice Hardware, Infuriating Setup Issues, Terrible Insecure Software," and so I'm going to share the review. Because it's perfectly written and there's no fluff in it. He said, "There's a lot to like about this hardware, but unfortunately, it's entirely overwhelmed by everything there is to hate about it. But before we get to that, I received this product at a discount in return for writing an honest review of it. Onwards. Packaging is entirely reasonable. There's a small cardboard box, a sheet of instructions, and a piece of hardware securely wrapped in bubble wrap. It's very small, but feels well-built. There's no creaking plastic under pressure, and no parts feel loose. Once it's plugged in, a blue LED in the button starts blinking, waiting for you to set it up. The app attempts to walk you through the setup, but things start going wrong here. The system is based on the ESP8266 module, which Matthew writes is a great choice for this sort of application. Oh, and by the way, if you Google ESP8266, it is everywhere. SparkFun offers it for like $7 or something. It is a wonderful looking little thing. Wi-Fi, built-in 32-bit processor, a meg of flash memory. So it's a full system for connecting any of your IoT stuff to Wi-Fi. So again, so I agree with Matthew. It's a beautiful little thing. Unfortunately, it wasn't very well designed from not it, but the people who used it to build a smart plug around. He says it's cheap, meaning inexpensive, but well-featured. There's a lot of easy off-the-shelf code that vendors can incorporate into it to cut down development time and ship better products faster. One of the features available is something called Smart Connect. And I should mention, I need to find out about this because this really sounds like the right way to go with IoT setup. He says, where an app on a phone encodes your Wi-Fi password into network broadcasts of different lengths. Now, I don't know what that means exactly, but that's why I need to dig into it. He says it's possible to detect these even without the password. So this allows your phone, although I have to make sure that like other people can't see this broadcast. That maybe it's not such a good idea. Anyway, this allows your phone to pass the information to the socket without having to fiddle about connecting to a different network. Simply hold down the power button to enter setup mode, and the phone does the rest. At least it does in theory. In practice, it fails for two reasons. The first is that it'll happily try to do this on a 5 gigahertz network, even though the socket, that is your phone, will try to do it on a 5 gigahertz network, even though the socket only has 2.4 gigahertz support. The other is that the app doesn't have the appropriate permissions to do this on Android 6. So it doesn't work on new Android phones at all, even if you are on a 2.4 gigahertz network. However, it also supports a more traditional setup mode, which we've talked about before, by holding down the power button again, it turns into an access point. Then the phone sees it, connects to it, and that allows the phone to then get the network setup data into the plug. And he says, again, at least in theory. In practice, the app is looking for a network called Smart Plug. And this version of the hardware creates a network called XW-G03. So it never finds it. I was like, how could this possibly work? So he says, I ended up reverse engineering the app in order to find out the configuration packet format, sent it myself, and so this guy's got some serious skills, and finally had the socket on the network. This is, needless to say, not a reasonable thing to expect average users to do. The alternative is to find an older Android device or use an iPhone to do the setup. Finally, once it's working, you can just hit a button on the app and your socket turns on or off. You can also program a timer. If your phone is connected to the same network as the socket, then this is just done by sending a command directly. But if not, you send a command via an intermediate server in China. Sit down, everybody. The socket connects to the server when it joins the wireless network and then waits for commands. So it has a static connection to a server in China waiting for on-off commands. The command packets look like they're encrypted, but in reality, there's no real cryptography at all. So it's just some light obfuscation. He says, I wrote a simple program to decode the packets and looked at them in more detail. There's a lot of unnecessary complexity in the packet format, but in the end, the relevant things are just a command and the MAC address of the socket. On the local network, this is sent directly to the socket. Otherwise, it goes via the server in China. The server looks at the address and uses that to decide which socket, that is, which AC socket, to pass it on to. Other than the destination, the packets are identical. This is a huge problem. If anybody knows the MAC address of one of your sockets, which remember, this is all in the, essentially in the clear data. Anybody, for example, sniffing traffic to that server anywhere along the line would be able to get the MAC addresses of all of the sockets currently in use in the world. Anyway, so if anybody knows the MAC address of one of your sockets, they can control it from anywhere in the world. You cannot set a password to stop them. And a normal home router configuration won't block this because, of course, it creates an outbound connection that the router NAT allows through, as it does all outbound connections. You need to explicitly firewall off the server, and then it gives the IP address of 115.28.45.50. And, of course, we don't know if that's after a domain lookup or if that's hard-coded, he says, in order to protect yourself. Again, this is completely unrealistic to expect for a home user. And if you do this, then you'll also entirely lose the ability to control the device from outside your home. In summary, by default, this is stupendously insecure. There's no reasonable way to make it secure. And if you do make it secure, then it's much less useful than it's supposed to be. He says, don't buy it. And by the way, one star is the lowest you can do. You cannot do a zero star, unfortunately, because I tried once. When you Amazon doesn't recognize you're initiating a review until you select one to five stars. You can't do zero. So, you know, otherwise he probably would have. Anyway, TechCrunch's Kate Conger reached out to Matthew, and she wrote in TechCrunch's coverage of this, she said, Garrett sent me a few emails he received from the company. Here's one, quote, "Just now, my boss has blamed me, and he said if I do not remove this bad review, he will quit me. Please help me," the representative wrote. "Could you please change your bad review into good?" Then Kate writes, Garrett responded that he would update the review if the manufacturer fixed the flaw. Entirely reasonable. And here it is. A, capital A, letter U, then capital Y-O-U. So A, lowercase u, Y-O-U is the company. The A-U represent, maybe it's A-U-U. Anyway, I don't know.
No one knows representative how you pronounce it.
Insisted she would be fired if the review was not updated. A week later, she followed up again, asking Garrett to take down the review. The representative then said that she would report Garrett to Amazon if he didn't take down the review, and that other Amazon reviewers had written in to complain about it. Well, first of all, I doubt that's true. He has an insane number of upvotes, something like 1,800 positive votes, and only 10 weren't. So, you know, everybody, the 10 employees at AUU all said bad review, bad review. The other 1,800 people said thank you to Matthew for this. So again, Kate writing said, Garrett says he leaves a lot of security based reviews on Amazon, and this has never happened to him. Of course, no one needs to lose their job over a single Amazon review. Well, except maybe in China. Garrett says he's not sure if he's being manipulated or if someone's job really is on the line. My take is, sorry, that's completely irrelevant to the fact that he's doing a service by taking a look at this. He says, he wrote to Kate, if I thought that there was a realistic chance that people were going to lose their jobs over something I was writing, that's something that would make me reconsider, he wrote. On the other hand, the attitude that many companies have of not giving any indication of caring about the security of the people they're selling to is horrifying in its own way. That is important to make people aware when choosing these devices. And of course, you couldn't, you know, you're speaking to the, you're, you know, singing to the choir on that count. I am so grateful that we are still in a world where this is legal. That is, you know, the great threat of DMCA-ish legislation would make it dangerous for someone to do what Matthew has done, to take a look at how this stuff is working. You know, this is such a perfect case in point of how we desperately need to keep researchers who are not malicious, clearly, who have the intent of improving products. Look at Tavis with Project Zero and what he, I mean, yes, egg is on Symantec's face. And by the way, I skipped over, I just forgot that the blurb there about the fact that Symantec was using open source software that 7 years ago had vulnerabilities that had been disclosed, for which there is exploit code that works against this stuff that they've installed into everyone's kernels who are using this AV. So, you know, we have to protect this ability to have people challenge otherwise closed systems that are not open, so that people can pry into them and see what's going on. We have to. And by the way, I did look at all of Matthew's other reviews, and he is, I think it were like 14 reviews, very much the same. I mean, not fluff at all, but really taking a close look at the way these things are working. So I just finished by noting that the plug appears to have been taken down from Amazon. And I just saw before the podcast that The Verge had reported the same thing. Matthew's review remains with a permalink, but I could not find the plug. And then looking at the other products that the same company makes, this AUU, they have two full home security systems, which just makes me shudder. It's like, okay, these people should not be doing internet-based connected products of this sort. They just don't demonstrate the ability to do it right. Wow. Okay, so errata, two things. First of all, last week I used a word that I didn't know the definition of, apparently, despite the fact that back here is the AED or the OED. OED.
Yeah, I see it.
OED. Yeah. I haven't read it recently.
Not cover to cover anyway, I hope.
I said penultimate when I was describing soft ice as the penultimate debugger for DOS. Huh. And a number of listeners said, okay, so what's the ultimate? And then I looked it up. It's like, well, it's penultimate means
ultimate.
second best.
Yeah, it's one before the
thinking,
ultimate.
Who made up this word? I don't want a word like that floating around for people to use wrong. How? Okay, give me a use for that word. What possible use is this annoying penultimate word? You know, who wants that?
All right, I'll give you an example. All right. In my opinion, the best episodes of any Game of Thrones series is the penultimate episode.
See, now no one knows what that means.
Well, I know what it means.
It's the you and last. Three other people. And they all sent me email or text.
You heard from everyone, all seven people who knew. Ultimate and penultimate are not the same thing.
I got that.
Yes.
And we just remove penultimate completely. It's useful.
No, it's useful. The penultimate episode of Game of Thrones is always the best
show.
Well,
in this case, I have to agree with you.
That's always the case.
That one is useful. But just say second to last, because then we all know what we're talking about.
Okay.
Anyway, so there's that one. Second is, I have had version control in place for decades. I didn't want to get into it because mine is my own. And it's not GitHub, it's not cloud-based, but so many people who understand the value of a version control generically tweeted and said, or sent email and said, oh, come on, Gibson, how can you even be like calling yourself a programmer? It's like, okay. So I have absolute backtracking auditing on every piece of code that I write. It's built into my infrastructure. I can go back in time on a file-by-file basis, not even like checkpoint-by-checkpoint, but individual tracking back the changes in all of my source code as far back as I want, with high granularity in the near term and slowly reducing granularity as the files get older, because the presumption is I don't need as much back then. So, yes.
And you wrote that yourself. That's cool.
I'm sorry really that cool. I was glib about it, you know, but believe me, and it's the kind of thing where you normally don't need it, but oh, baby, when you do. In fact, yeah. I've used it just a couple times. I'm tracking down a weird bug in the Squirrel client that I introduced inadvertently, obviously, when I updated the identity system to maintain four previous identities. It had deep repercussions throughout what the code I already written. And so several times I've gone back a few months before I did that to take a look at like what I had then. So yes, rest assured, everybody who knows how important it is, I've got it too. And I wouldn't live without it. There have even been times like when I've just, you know, fumbled a finger and hit delete on a source file. It's like, ooh, you know, I just, you sort of stare blankly for a minute and then it's like, okay. And, good news is I have something from 10 minutes ago, so I'm fine. Anyway, yes, I absolutely understand the need for it and have it. Real quick note for our sci-fi interested media viewers, that two shows that are they're not top drawer, but they're post sci-fi reboot that we've talked about. Their second seasons just started, and I know that many of our listeners are watching. And it's two shows, Killjoys and Dark Matter. I think Dark Matter is the better of the two, and they're just, you know, romp 'em, shoot 'em up, space team stuff. But they're fun, and so I wanted to make sure that people knew that they had resumed last Friday. I've not even watched them yet. I've been really busy, but I will, because they were fun and you know, sort of character driven. I mean, there's like not amazing, but they're okay. And for those of us who are interested in politics, completely off topic, but this will be quick. This week's Bitly shortcut. So bit.ly/SN-567 is the cover story of this month's Atlantic magazine is titled How American Politics Went Insane. On Sunday's Meet the Press, Chuck Todd interviewed the author, and the things he said immediately brought me to attention. Because it echoed a conversation I've been having with my mom, sort of about sort of processing what we're seeing in this U.S. cycle's presidential election, and I won't go any further. But I won't take up any more time. But that I should say that link is to a PDF I prepared. I mean, I'm obviously a political follower, and I've been wanting to understand what's going on. This is a great piece. And so it's a PDF that my site is hosting. I put the cover on it so that the Atlantic would get all of the credit for it. And it is freely available on the web also. How American Politics Went Insane. And for what it's worth, if you follow politics, I recommend it without reservation. It's long. It's about 20 pages. Although the first page is all just cover, but worthwhile if you're interested in such things. And I did want to make a note that, as I promised last week, the second generation of the Healthy Sleep Formula page is updated and online. I'm not finished with it, but all the important stuff is there, and I'll be adding to it shortly. And finally, I got a nice note from Jeremy Like, spelled L-E-I-K, and he wrote, pronounced like, blame my German ancestors, in Diamondale, or Demondale, Michigan. Don't know. Demondale, maybe. And he said, Spinright mentioned on technibble.com. He said, hello, Steve and Leo. I'm writing today because I'm a user of Spinright and a believer in its capabilities. It has saved a few drives for me and allowed me to recover data from a RAID array that came out of a NAS with failed electronics. I came across an article called Technical Overview of Popular Software Data Recovery Procedures over at TechNibble. They mention Spinright on page 2 of their article. The part where they describe Spinright seems pretty simplistic and lumps it in with other software tools. I would be interested in hearing from the horse's mouth, so to speak, what your thoughts are on this subject. Thanks so much, Jeremy Like. And so I'll just say that I completely understand that. One of the good things about Spinright is that it is so simple to use. I mean, its goal is to fix your drive, and that's what you do. That's what it does. You run it, you point it at the drive, and it goes and fixes it. And so it doesn't look like there's much there. But when I was thinking about what Jeremy wrote, I was reminded of a person I hired 20 years ago by the name of Mike Totonghi, who was an incredibly brilliant person, and which is why I hired him. And he'd been with GRC for, I don't know, a few months, and we were having lunch together. And I started explaining to him, he said something like that, like indicated how unimpressed he was with Spinrite. I mean, you know, it was paying his salary at the time, but like, he just didn't think there was much there. And so I said, okay, Mike, let me tell you what's in here. And I started to go into it. And over the course of about an hour, what it really takes to do what Spinrite does, what Spinrite completely hides. And he was stunned. He said he could not believe that never occurred to him what would be necessary to do what it does and how it works. And a lot of that was proprietary. So there is stuff I don't talk about, because it is what pays all the bills. But Mike sort of outgrew my little company. There wasn't room for both of us. So I was good friends with Brad Silverberg, who was one of the executive VPs at Microsoft at the time. And I gave Brad a call and I said, hey, Brad, I've got somebody for you. Mike did go to Microsoft. He was the MVP, the number one most valuable employee of the year at Microsoft, and became one of their 12. They have like a special designation, like something scientist or something. I mean, he's like, he did .NET. He invented that JV, the whole .NET system himself. So anyway, he knows where he's coming from software wise, which is why I hired him. He was blown away. So for what it's worth, what I love about Spinrite, like most of my software, is it just does what you want it to. And it deals with all of the hard stuff itself, which is what makes it fun for me to create it in the first place. And the bottom line is you run it and it fixes your drive. So, Jeremy, I'm not surprised that somebody, trying to do a review piece sort of says, oh, yeah, and here's a bunch of other stuff, and there's something called Spinrite, and, blah. It's like, okay, except, it works.
It works.
For the last almost 30 years now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have enough, I think, anecdotal evidence to say.
Oh, my goodness.
It absolutely works.
Yeah, at some point it stops being anecdotal.
Yeah.
It becomes rigorous.
Yeah. Hey, let's take a break, and then we will talk about the subject of the day, which is what?
Hacking certificates.
Hacking certificates.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean like the Let's Encrypt?
Yeah. This StartCom is the CA that decided to do the same thing. Let's Encrypt.
Oh, I could do that. I could write a script. Anybody could do that. It's easy.
What could possibly go wrong?
We'll find out in a moment. But first, let's talk about entering the 21st century with Rocket Mortgage. You know, if you've ever bought a house or refinanced, you know that this is a process with its roots deep in 16th century Holland, I think, where financial markets were invented. And paperwork was king. A lot of paperwork. But Rocket Mortgage, which is new from Quicken Loans, has taken all that complicated, time-consuming, paperwork-laden parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. You can do it all online right now, whether you're refinancing or buying a house. Rocket Mortgage makes it easy, even from the comfort of your couch on an iPad or a tablet or a phone. With Rocket Mortgage, you can share your bank statements, your pay stubs at the touch of a button. You can get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution. That's another thing technology's helped out a lot. You can get that mortgage solution that's just right for you, tailored to your unique situation. And the fact that you can do this without a lot of paperwork is amazing. It's all online. I love that idea. So if you're looking to refi, if you're looking to buy a house, if you're home hunting and you want to pre-qualify, check out Rocket Mortgage today. It's at Quicken Loans. So go to quickenloans.com/security now. Quickenloans.com/security now. When the time has come to buy a new house or to refinance, do it the easy way. You're computer literate. That's why they're reaching out to you. They know if you're listening to this show, you're definitely comfortable with technology, and that's who Rocket Mortgage was invented for. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Go to quickenloans.com/security now when it's time. Rocket Mortgage. We thank you, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, for your support of Security Now. All right. Let's write a script. Let's encrypt.
So, let's not do one for certificates. So, where is NL, the domain? That's Norway?
Netherlands,
right. CompuTest is a security group in the Netherlands who took a look at a newly launched service called Start Encrypt. So it's like, okay, uh-huh. So, you know, let's encrypt, start encrypt. At least they didn't try to steal the trademark the way Komodo did. So the company is Start.com, and they have this so-called Start SSL are their certificates. And so the Start Encrypt project was launched on June 4th. So, a month ago. And of course, it was inspired by the success of the Let's Encrypt project. Okay, well, I loved CompuTest's disclosure because it was almost comically understated. And I don't know if it's a English language translation thing. It was just so polite, and it's discussing something that is so horrifying. So they wrote, recently, one of our hackers found a critical vulnerability in Start.com's new Start Encrypt tool that allows an attacker to gain valid SSL certificates for domains he does not control. Which is like, what? So we have a trusted certificate authority whose entire raison d'être is to make sure that the identity of the people they are issuing certs to has been verified. Anyway, they continue with this understatement. While there are some restrictions on what domains the attack could be applied to, domains where the attack will work include Google.com, Facebook.com, Live.com, Dropbox.com, and others. Yeah, we heard of them. Start.com, known for its CA service under the name of Start SSL, has recently released the Start Encrypt tool, modeled after Let's Encrypt. This service allows for the easy and free installation of SSL certificates on servers. In the current age of surveillance and cybercrime, this is a great step forward, since it enables website owners to provide their visitors with better security at small effort and no cost. And of course, we've talked about what a fabulous success Let's Encrypt has been. And you can imagine the position that Start SSL is in. Now, they had been offering free certs, limited time. You'd have to keep going back every year and had that so that there would be a chance for them to upsell. But still, the Let's Encrypt model is better than free because it's free and it's automated. So they think, okay, let's automate. And then continuing CompuTest's statement, they said, however, there's a lot that can go wrong with the automated issuance of SSL certificates. Before someone is issued a certificate for their domain, say CompuTest.nl, the CA needs to check that the request is done by someone who is actually in control of the domain. For extended validation certificates, this involves a lot of paperwork and manual checking. But for simple so-called domain validated certificates, DV certificates, often an automated check is used by sending an email to the domain or asking the user to upload a file. The CA, the certificate authority, has a lot of freedom in how to in how that check is performed, but ultimately the requester is provided with a certificate that provides the same secure, and this is the key too, the requester is provided with a certificate that provides the same security no matter which CA issued it, right? Because all of the CA's private keys, which are used to verify the signing under, I'm sorry, all of the CA's public keys are in the devices we used, which are used to verify the signing under the CA's secret private key. So we treat all certificates identically, regardless of what CA signed it. So they say, in order to make the issuance of certificates easy, this tool runs on your server, Windows or Linux, detects your web server configuration, and requests DV certificates for the domains that were found in your config. So that's nice. It looks into your config, sees which domains your server's configured to handle, and just asks for those certificates. Then the StartCom API, meaning at the server end, does an HTTP request. I just hit space bar and change the page. Sorry. Does an HTTP request to the website at the domain you requested a certificate for. So the far end, the StartCom server, makes a request to check for the presence of a piece of proof that you have access to the website. So the idea being that remotely it uses that domain to ask for a specific file, which then verifies that you were able to put that file on that domain, therefore you're controlling the server at that location. So it checks for the presence of a piece of proof that you have access to that website. If the proof is found, the API returns a certificate to the client, which then installs it into your config. So very much like what's like Let's Encrypt, it just automates the whole process. However, they write, it appears that the Start Encrypt tool, and I love this, did not receive proper attention from security-minded people in the design and implementation phases. Now, understand, it's not like security is an afterthought for a certificate authority. It's a stretch to call an afterthought for a AC wall plug, but security is not an afterthought for a certificate authority.
Oh, security schmicurity.
Such a stickler. Get a load of this. So they write, while the client contains numerous vulnerabilities, we do get to those at the end, one in particular allows the attacker to trick the validation step. So the first bug, the API, as we noted, checks if a user is authorized to obtain a certificate for a domain by downloading a signature, which is like, a file, from that domain. By default, from the path /sign file. However, the client, at the user's end, the client chooses that path during an HTTP post request to that API, meaning that a malicious client can specify a path to any file on the server for which a certificate is being requested. This means that, for example, anyone can obtain a certificate for sites like Dropbox.com and GitHub.com, where users can upload their own files. So the point here is, just to clarify.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah. You don't have access to the root of Dropbox. You have access to some screwy-looking URL with a bunch of gobbledygook in it.
But it begins with Dropbox.com.
Exactly. And so you're able to make a request of the Startcom in your HTTP post query to their API. The actual post contains the path slash file or slash sign file. You simply change that to your directory on Dropbox where you placed that file on Dropbox, and Startcom sends you a completely valid HTTPS certificate for Dropbox.com. How handy. Now you can have your own Dropbox.
Oh, my God. That's ridiculous.
I know. Unbelievable. And then they say, that's not all. While this is serious, most websites don't allow you to upload a file and then have it presented back to you in raw format like GitHub and Dropbox do. So those are sort of unique in that they are file storage sites, which just make this exploit drop dead or Dropbox simple. Another issue in the API, the Startcom API, however, allows for much wider exploitation of this issue. The API follows redirects. So if the URL specified in one of these post parameters called verify res parameter returns a redirect to another URL, the API will follow that until it gets to the proof that it's looking for. Even if the redirect goes off domain, which is just crazy, since the first redirect was to the domain that is being verified, the API considers the proof correct even if it is redirected to a different website. Okay, so again, to review, that would mean that you're asking for something from literally, and this works, Google.com. Why does it work? Because Google is an OAuth provider. And OAuth requires URL redirection following in order for it to bounce the user's web browser around, as we've talked about in the past. So this Startcom API is so broken that if it goes to Google.com and receives a redirect somewhere else, it says, oh, I got a redirect from Google.com, but that verifies the guy has control of Google.com. Even though Google then sent it somewhere else that the user actually has control over. So this indirection allows opens up a much broader range of exploitation, because it basically people can arrange to have a Google URL redirect wherever they want, and that is then where they put the content that this Startcom API picks up. And these are called open redirects. They're pages that take a parameter that contains a URL and that redirect the user to that URL in the page's parameter. Now, this mechanism makes people nervous, but for example, we often see it in login and logout pages where you'll log out and the logout URL will say like have an argument like return URL equals slash login, so that after you log out, the web server bounces the browser over to the login page. And it turns out that The OAuth, as I mentioned before, requires open redirects. It's not technically a security vulnerability unless, in this instance, it's able to be leveraged into a huge vulnerability as a consequence of the fact that the thing that is following the redirections takes the first domain as the one that's being verified rather than the last domain where it actually gets the asset whose ownership it's trying to prove. So, I mean, you know, it's just like, okay, this is a certificate authority that everybody trusts. And they've automated this with gaping holes in their API. So, so anyway, they say that's still not all. Apart from the vulnerabilities described above, we found some other vulnerabilities in the client while just doing a cursory check. We're only publishing those that, according to StartCom, have been fixed or are no issue. These include the client doesn't check. Okay, the client running in the user's machine, right, in the user's server, that reaches out and connects to the remote StartCom server. The client, their own software, doesn't check the server's certificate for validity when connecting to the API, which, of course, is pretty ironic for an SSL tool. And so I added a note here, which, of course, allows for man-in-the-middle attacks against the Start Encrypt client. Bad guys could arrange to have invalid certificates issued, thus creating a denial of service against targeted sites using Start Encrypt, because it's not checking the certificate. So it just could be any certificate that that is set up on a man-in-the-middle intercepting server. And they're not, that interceptor is not going to be a CA, so it just sends garbage back, and that garbage gets installed into the end user's server, and look, HTTPS is broken. Wow. And, you know, who knows what else, what other kind of havoc could be created. Second, the API doesn't verify the content type of the file it downloads for verification. So attackers can obtain certificates for, and get this, attackers can obtain certificates for any website where users can upload their own avatars, like a blogging site where you create an account with a profile and you upload a picture. So you would upload that sign file as your picture and then hand that URL to the StartCom API or the Start Encrypt API, and it would give you a certificate for that site, that social site where you create an account. Just incredible. And finally, the private, and you'll get this, Leo, because you've been deep into Linux recently, the private key, right? The final sacrosanct private key, which, by the way, is over a connection whose security is not verified, the private key on the server, which now that's what on the end user's server, the private key on the server is saved with file mode 666. So it's world readable. Which means any local process or user on that machine can read or modify it. And that's the secret for that server's certificate, the private wow. key, the thing you wow. absolutely never want to let anyone else get. So all in all, doesn't seem like a lot of attention was paid to security in the design and implementation of this piece of software, they say. And it's like, you think? Wow. Yeah.
Nice job.
What Let's Encrypt did is good. The bad news is, you know, wannabe Me Too companies are going to say, oh, we're, you know, we're losing free business to Let's Encrypt, so we should do it too. And here's an example of how badly it can go wrong. And boy, again, this we just don't have facilities in place for policing this. Again, I will say thank goodness that researchers are able to look at these things and are able to bring, you know, responsibly bring them to light. And all of us can learn lessons from them because, and hopefully all the other CAs are going, oh, you know, we were going to launch ours next month. Let's maybe we should just check it.
Maybe,
you know, maybe we should.
Maybe 777 would be better than 666. Let's just go all the way and let people execute it.
That's right.
Wow. You know, that's kind of amazing. This stuff, you know, the proof file.
Security
is
well
known, but this is a well known thing about.
I know. This is embarrassing.
Is easy.
This is embarrassing.
Yeah.
This is just. I mean, I love that last sentence. All in all, and they wrote this. It doesn't seem like a lot of attention was paid to security.
It's called understatement.
In the design and implementation of this piece of software. And again, it's not even a plug. It's a certificate authority issuing certificates that the world is going to trust. Oh, and you can get one for Google.
Yep.
Wow.
Well, my friend, we have concluded this fabulous episode of Things Done Wrong. And a few things done right. You can catch this show. We do it every Tuesday at about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to watch live at twit.tv. But you don't have to. Of course, we have on-demand audio and video. Steve does a great job of not only putting the audio up there, but of written transcriptions at grc.com. That's his website.
We may be a little bit late with it this week. Elaine was saying, oh, Steve, please do a shorter podcast because my schedule is really jammed up. And she's so responsible. She's so responsible that, you know, she's just going to take it out on herself. So, Elaine, you're listening. Oh, actually, this is the end. So, but she does a whole proofreading phase.
Right.
So,
right.
Elaine, you're halfway through. Please, you're hearing us both say, take
your
time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No worries.
I'll post it up when we get a chance because here we are at 2 hours and 2 minutes and counting. So it's our standard length podcast.
Yeah. GRC.com. You'll also find, if you want questions, I guess we'll do a question episode next week. You can, of course, go to grc.com/feedback. That's the feedback form. Or tweet Steve. He's at SGGRC. You can even DM him because he accepts DMs from all comers.
Yeah, don't send tweets to at Steve Gibson. That really annoys him.
Is there a guy named at Steve Gibson?
Oh, yeah. And he sometimes bounces tweets over to me. He says, no, it's... It was like, I'll say, hey, I'm sorry, but, you know.
At SGGRC. See? Easy. It's his initials plus his website's name, but not .com, because that, never mind. At SGGRC. And, you know, I have the other ones up there. You probably don't do much with SGPad and SGVLC.
No, that was sort of an interesting idea, but it
I
didn't work.
I'll release those.
Didn't gain enough traction.
Yeah. One Twitter handle's enough for any human.
Yeah. And by the way, we're closing in on 1.5 million downloads of Never 10.
Wow. Well, so, you've got till July 29th.
Oh, yeah.
Well, to go over the billion number.
15,000 a day now. It's slowing down, but still staying strong.
That's great. That's amazing.
Yeah. Crazy.
You'll find many other things at the website, including SpinRite, of course, Steve's amazing product that does work. The world's best hard drive maintenance recovery utility.
There's a lot of magic under the hood that people don't appreciate, but that's why it works.
GRC.com again for that. Now, if you go to twit.tv/SN, you'll find audio and video, so you can see Steve's giant hands.
Or head.
It's a trick of perspective, my friends. His hands are just normal. Just look big. I guess that's about it. I guess that wraps it up for another fabulous week. Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Leo. Great to be with you, as always.
Security Now.